Welcome to The Deep Dive, a deeper look at sermons from Faithway Fellowship Baptist Church.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting one today.
It is. But before we get into the heavy lifting, just a quick reminder for you listening. You can catch all these sermons over on YouTube, Facebook, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
Right. They're everywhere.
Exactly. And for all the details, you can just head directly to the website at faithwayfbc.com.
Highly recommend going there to, you know, get the full context.
For sure. So let's talk about the mission for today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are exploring the razor-thin and honestly quite terrifying line between a society's profound faith and its complete generational collapse.
Yeah, which sounds dramatic, but it's really not.
No, it's reality.
Yeah.
We're looking at the mechanics of how a culture totally unravels, but more importantly, how a person actually stands their ground and rebuilds when, you know, absolutely everything around them feels like it's falling to pieces.
And the material today maps out the psychology of both that decline and that restoration in just a, well, a really vivid way. We aren't just looking at ancient historical timelines here. I mean, we are dissecting the mechanics of human nature when it is under extreme pressure.
Right. And we're pulling this from two deeply connected sermons delivered by Pastor Tim Travis. And the first one starts with this genuinely chilling biblical precedent in the book of Judges, specifically chapter 2.
It's a heavy chapter.
It really is. There is this stark narrative hook that describes an entire society unraveling because of one single hinge point in history. Now, I quote the scripture here. It reads, "There arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord."
Yeah, that's the one.
That one line just hits like a ton of bricks. I mean, a whole society comes undone in a blink.
Because Pastor Tim Travis uses that verse to illustrate the terrifying speed at which a nation can just lose its foundational identity.
It's so fast.
It is. The generation that actually fought the physical battles, right?
Yeah.
The ones who saw the miracles firsthand, they died off. And the very next generation, the people who were supposed to carry the torch, they had absolutely no working knowledge of who God was or what he had done.
Wow.
It is a complete wipeout of institutional memory.
And the sermon brings this ancient warning straight into modern America.
Yeah.
Now, quick sidebar for you listening. Our job today isn't to take a political side on these specific cultural flashpoints, left or right.
Right, exactly. We're just, you know, reporting what's there.
Yeah, we're here to impartially map out the architecture of his argument. We're not endorsing these viewpoints or picking a political lane. But to make his case, Pastor Tim Travis cites what he describes as anti-God rhetoric currently being taught in major colleges.
Okay, yeah.
He also points to the removal of the Ten Commandments from public offices, and he mentions lawsuits from Muslims regarding the use of public spaces. And on the flip side, he specifically praises the state of Texas for taking steps to return the Bible to public schools.
So he's tying all these modern events back to that Judges verse.
Exactly. Again, impartially unpacking it here, his core argument is that a nation is only one generation away from extinction.
And the architecture of that argument really hinges on the idea that cultural extinction, it doesn't require centuries of slow decay.
Right.
Like, it can happen in the span of a single uninstructed generation. The cultural shifts he is highlighting, they're presented as symptoms of a society that has entirely severed the core to its foundational beliefs.
Wait, but let me push back on that for a second.
Sure.
Isn't this just, I don't know, a tale as old as time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every older generation complains that the youth are losing their way.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you can dig up quotes from ancient Greek philosophers grumbling about how the youth of their day are disrespectful and ignoring the old gods.
Yeah, Socrates famously complained about it.
Exactly. So how is this biblical warning any different from just normal, everyday generational friction where the parents just don't understand the kids?
That's a great question. And the distinction Pastor Tim Travis draws here is really the crux of the entire first sermon.
Okay.
Judges 2 isn't describing youthful rebellion. Think about what rebellion actually is.
It's pushing boundaries.
Right. But rebellion implies that you know the rules, you understand the boundaries, and you are actively, defiantly choosing to break them.
Oh, I see.
The text is pointing to utter ignorance. This new generation didn't know God and angrily reject him. They had literally never heard of him.
It's a complete blank slate.
Exactly.
But how does that even happen? How does an entire generation completely fail to pass down its most deeply held beliefs?
Well,
because there has to be a breakdown in the living room before there's a breakdown in the culture, right?
It's exactly it.
Yeah.
The breakdown happened because of compromise.
Yeah,
Pastor Tim Travis points out that this ignorance is actually a massive indictment of the forefathers. Yeah. It represents a catastrophic failure of the older generation. If you look back at Judges chapter 1, those forefathers were explicitly commanded to fully drive out the negative influences and the enemy nations around them.
Okay, but they didn't.
No, they didn't do it. They did a really lackluster job. They left what the text calls a lingering people among them.
Why leave them, though? Was it just like laziness?
It was a mixture of comfort, complacency, and economic convenience.
Ah, of course. Money.
Always, right? It was physically exhausting to keep fighting, and it was economically advantageous to subjugate some of these lingering people and just use them for labor.
Wow.
So the older generation prioritized their immediate comfort over their spiritual conviction. They made a compromise.
Which seems small at the time, maybe.
Right. But the tragedy is that the parents' compromise became the children's baseline.
Oh, that's heavy.
The kids grew up in an environment saturated with negative influences, constantly subjected to the peer pressure of these lingering people, and they had absolutely no knowledge of the truth to anchor them.
So the parents built the very environment that starved their kids of the truth.
Exactly.
Okay, so you have this vacuum of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But how does a culture go from simply lacking knowledge, like just being ignorant, to actively destroying itself?
Yeah, it's a leap.
Because there is still a massive jump between, I don't know who God is, and total societal collapse.
Well, the bridge between ignorance and destruction is indifference.
Indifference.
Yes. When you don't know the truth, you don't respect the boundaries that the truth inherently provides, you lose all sense of spiritual danger.
Right.
Ignorance breeds a highly toxic apathy where people just wander into minefields because they don't even know what a mine is.
Okay, this brings up this crazy story Pastor Tim Travis shared that perfectly visualizes this.
Oh, the zoo story.
Yes. So he talked about a Chinese woman who visited a wildlife park. And she decided she wanted a cool picture, so she literally climbed over a safety barrier to take a selfie with a snow leopard.
I still can't even believe that.
Yeah, right. She is standing 3 feet away from a literal apex predator, smiling for the camera. And 3 seconds later, the leopard mauled her face.
It's a brutal image, but it encapsulates the absolute peril of indifference.
Really?
She didn't respect the boundary because she was totally indifferent to the nature of the animal in front of her.
It's exactly like walking onto a skyscraper construction site and stepping out onto a steel beam 50 stories in the air without a hard hat or a safety harness simply because you don't believe in gravity.
Yeah, gravity doesn't care.
Exactly. Your personal ignorance of the danger does not stop the consequences from happening. The snow leopard does not care if you think it's a cute photo op. Its nature is to hunt.
Wow.
Gravity doesn't care if you believe in it. You're still going to fall. Ignorance does not grant you immunity from reality.
And that consequence of ignorance is really tied to human wiring. The sermon argues that human beings are fundamentally, inescapably wired to worship.
We have to worship something.
It is a default setting in our psychology. If a human being does not worship God, they do not just sit in a neutral state of worshiping nothing. They will default to worshiping themselves.
Because nature abhors a vacuum. Something has to sit on the throne.
Exactly. And when self is on the throne, the singular goal becomes immediate gratification. The search to fill that internal void inevitably leads a culture to serve the very enemies of God.
Like in Judges.
Yes. In the biblical text, those ancient Israelites ended up serving false gods like Baal and Ashtaroth. These were belief systems that involved horrific, indulgent practices.
Just terrible stuff.
And when you remove the boundaries of truth, you don't actually achieve freedom. You just get captured by the most destructive baseline elements of the culture around you. The Israelites wanted the immediate indulgence those false gods offered, and it destroyed their society.
Okay, so if that is the disease, apathy, ignorance, compromising with the lingering culture, and ending up taking a selfie with a snow leopard, how do we actively fight it?
Right, what's the cure?
Because that brings us to the second sermon, which is based in the book of Nehemiah. And this is a total pivot from the passive cultural decay in Judges to active, deliberate, and highly defensive rebuilding.
You can't just diagnose the collapse and leave it there. Nehemiah provides the ultimate historical case study in the remedy.
So to set the stage for you listening, Nehemiah is handed this monumental, almost impossible task of rebuilding the ruined walls of Jerusalem.
It was a massive undertaking.
Huge. And the core concept drawn out here is the idea of the sword and the trowel. The workers were under such a constant heavy threat of attack from the surrounding nations that they literally had to build the stone wall with a trowel in one hand while gripping a weapon for defense in the other hand.
Just incredible to picture.
They were doing construction and combat simultaneously.
And it perfectly captures the dual reality of a steadfast spiritual life. Think about the physical mechanics of that.
It sounds awful.
Building a stone wall with one hand is incredibly inefficient. It's exhausting. But it was necessary. You were constructing your faith, your family, your community, but you were forced to simultaneously guard against the negative influences, those same lingering people from Judges that actively want to tear your work down.
Practically speaking, though, what do you do about the critics?
Oh.
Because they weren't just under physical threat of attack. They were being relentlessly verbally abused.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep laying bricks when people are standing right there mocking your efforts?
That's where Pastor Tomb Travis points to the historical figures of Sanballat and Tobiah.
Okay.
These were enemies of Nehemiah who utilized psychological warfare. They stood by the construction site and literally laughed at the Israelites.
Was heckling them.
Yeah. They mocked the craftsmanship, claiming it was so incredibly weak that if a mere fox walked across the top of the wall, the whole thing would crumble.
That is just petty and meant to get under their skin.
It's totally petty, but it works.
Yeah, it does.
When you are trying to serve your community or build a healthy family or maintain your faith, there will always be an audience telling you it's not good enough or that your efforts are completely pointless.
Definitely.
The fascinating part is how Nehemiah handles it. The critics keep trying to bait him. They ask him to stop working and come down to the plain to meet with them, which was obviously a trap to halt the progress.
Right. Pull him off the wall.
But Nehemiah looks down and responds, "I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down."
Wow. I cannot come down. He didn't say, "I will not."
And the psychological difference between saying, "I won't come down" and "I can't come down" is profound.
How so?
Well, saying "I won't" relies entirely on human willpower. It implies that you still have the option on the table, but you are just choosing not to exercise it right now.
Okay, yeah.
And willpower always runs out eventually. Saying "I can't come down" represents a total, absolute surrender to the calling. It removes the option entirely. Coming down would be a direct violation of his deepest convictions.
It completely shifts the burden. You aren't arguing with the critic anymore. You are just bound by a higher law.
Exactly.
And to illustrate the difference between truly being anchored to a purpose like Nehemiah versus just having like fake situational dedication, the sermon features this highly memorable anecdote.
I love this story.
It's so funny but sad. There was a local news story about an apartment building that caught on fire. And there is this man standing on the third floor holding open the emergency exit door.
Right.
Smoke is billowing everywhere, the alarms are blaring, and all of his neighbors are safely filing past him out the door. After 30 minutes, he finally stumbles out of the building, coughing and covered in black soot.
The real hero moment.
Right. The local news cameras rush right up to him, calling him a hero, and the reporter asks, "What possessed him to be so incredibly dedicated to saving his neighbors?" And the guy looks at the camera and admits, "To be honest with you, my coat was stuck on the door latch. I couldn't get it free."
It is the ultimate counterexample.
True.
That man didn't stay because he had a mind to work or some deep sacrificial dedication to his community. He was just physically stuck.
If he could have unhooked his jacket, he would have bolted in the first 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Pastor Tim Travis uses this to challenge the listener's motivation. Are you serving out of a deep conviction that you cannot abandon the work? Or are you just physically stuck in a routine, holding on to a position, secretly waiting for a chance to bolt the second it gets uncomfortable?
Let's be real for a second, though.
Yeah.
Holding a sword in one hand, a trowel in the other, ignoring the psychological warfare of Sanballat and Tobiah, making sure your coat isn't just snagged on a door latch, that is deeply exhausting.
It really is.
What actually keeps a person stationed on that wall year after year, decade after decade, especially when it feels like absolutely nobody cares or even notices the work you're doing?
The reality of service is that it is frequently thankless. You are sweating over stones that most people will just walk past without a second thought. Pastor Tim Travis addresses this by managing our expectations about where our rewards actually come from.
Which brings up the story of Kevin Ford, which went viral on social media a while back.
Oh, man, yeah.
This man was a Burger King employee who worked as a cook and a cashier for 27 years. Over the course of almost three decades, he never missed a single day of work. No sick days, no vacations, just ultimate grinding dedication.
Amazing.
And when he hit his big retirement milestone, the multi-billion dollar company rewarded him with a goodie bag. Inside was a handful of candy, a single movie ticket, and a plastic coffee cup.
A plastic coffee cup for 27 years of flawless, unbroken service.
The internet was predictably outraged.
Yeah.
And they ended up raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for him through a GoFundMe, which is a fantastic ending for him.
Definitely.
But the sermon uses the initial insult of that corporate goodie bag as a profound metaphor.
And this is where you, the listener, need to evaluate your own life. Think about where you are serving right now. Maybe it's at your workplace where you are putting in late hours and nobody even acknowledges it. Maybe it is inside your own family, doing the invisible, exhausting labor of raising children or caring for an aging parent.
That's so true.
Or maybe it's in your spiritual life, volunteering week after week in your community. Do you feel like you are putting in decades of heavy lifting, holding that sword and trowel, only to be handed a proverbial plastic coffee cup at the end of the day?
It is incredibly disheartening when you feel unseen. But the ultimate point here is that true believers do not build for earthly recognition.
No, they don't.
You cannot build for the company goodie bag. You play for an audience of one.
Yeah.
You serve God, not the crowd. Because if you serve the crowd, the inevitable coffee cup will completely break your spirit.
When your motivation is firmly anchored in heaven, earthly slights and corporate insults simply don't have the power to make you drop your trowel.
Right.
But maintaining that heavenly perspective isn't a passive state. It requires active, constant calibration.
Which brings us to this brilliant analogy about cruise control.
Oh, this was great.
Think about driving down the highway with your cruise control set to 70 miles per hour. As long as the road is flat and easy, the car just hums along.
Super easy.
But the moment that car hits a steep hill, when it encounters real resistance, the engine has to downshift. It has to actively work harder, revving at a much higher RPM, burning more fuel, just to maintain that exact same speed.
Right.
If it didn't forcefully downshift, the car would just coast to a crawl and eventually roll backward.
And if we translate that to the spiritual life, believers hit hills all the time.
Always.
A hill could be a sudden personal tragedy, a wave of cultural decay, or just the sheer exhaustion of holding the trowel. When believers encounter this kind of resistance, they cannot just coast.
Yeah.
Pastor Tim Travis argues they must actively downshift by intentionally realigning themselves with the Word of God. They have to spend time recharging, even when it requires more energy, or they will coast right back into that spiritual apathy we saw destroying the culture in Judges.
You have to downshift to keep the speed.
Oh.
And downshifting is noisy. It takes effort. You have to open the book. You have to deliberately reset your mind, or you lose your momentum entirely.
It is the only way to sustain the raw energy required to hold both the weapon and the tool over a lifetime.
Let's step back and look at the incredible contrast we've explored today. On one side, you have the cautionary tale of Judges, an entire generation that simply forgets.
Yeah.
Because their forefathers prioritized comfort over conviction and failed to drive out the negative influences, the children slipped into utter ignorance. That ignorance bred indifference, leading them right over the safety barrier and into the jaws of the snow leopard.
Worshipping the very things that destroyed them.
Exactly. And fading into extinction.
But standing in direct opposition to that, you have the Nehemiah remedy. This is a generation that actually acknowledges the broken walls around them. They refuse to be mocked into submission by the critics, and they take up both the sword and the trowel.
They don't just stand there.
Right. They actively defend against cultural decay while meticulously, painstakingly building a lasting legacy. And they do it knowing they're working for an audience of one, refusing to let the disappointment of a plastic coffee cup stop their progress.
It is the stark choice between passive collapse and active construction.
Yeah.
But before we wrap up today, we want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to ponder.
Something to mull over.
Yeah, something that builds on everything we've just discussed.
Consider this. If we spend all of our time and energy fiercely guarding the wall with our swords, intensely focused on defense against the critics and the culture, and we spend every ounce of our remaining energy meticulously building the wall higher with our trowels to keep our own community safe, who is making sure the gates are left open to actually welcome and teach that dreaded next generation?
Wow, that's out.
How do we ensure that in our absolute zeal to build a secure fortress, we don't accidentally leave the youth locked outside in the dark, ultimately causing the exact generational extinction event we were trying so hard to prevent in the first place?
Are we building a wall that protects or a wall that isolates? You can't just stack the stones, you have to manage the gates.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us as we walk the line between extinction and building. We hope this deep dive gave you the tools you need, whether that's a sword, a trowel, or maybe just a reminder to downshift on the hills to build something that lasts. See you next time.